Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I am your host, Emma Gunn Wardner, and joining me in this episode is the journalist and author Poorna Bell. Now, I met Poorna a couple of months ago at a press screening of Deadpool 2, if you please. Thank you, Terry White. But when she introduced herself, I realised I'd been following her and liking her posts on social media for quite some time. There was that rather brilliant moment where she said, "Hi, I'm Poorna," and I said, "Ooh, Poorna Bell, I follow you on Twitter." Listeners, I am nothing if not incredibly cool socially. For those of you who don't follow Poorna, and I suggest you do, she's an award-winning journalist and author who's written for The Pool, Red Magazine, Stylist, Women's Health, The Huffington Post, and many more. Now, I knew that she had written a book. I knew it was called Chase the Rainbow. But as regular listeners of the show will know, it was on my TBR pile. Shame on me. After meeting Poorna, I bumped it to the top of the list, and as soon as I'd finished it, I emailed her and asked if she'd like to come on the podcast to discuss it. Thankfully, she said yes. Chase the Rainbow is an incredibly personal account of Poorna's relationship with her husband and addresses depression and addiction head-on. As the book's paperback tagline reads, "One man's journey with mental health told by the woman who loved him." It's an incredible piece of work, and I don't just say that because I think anything that has made it from a brain into a cohesive series of words is impressive, but because it's joyful, tragic, painful, and beautiful. I'm loath to say anything more because it's one of those experiences that I'd rather you guys had yourself rather than me sharing mine with you, if that makes sense. In this conversation, we talk about the stigma of mental health and why it's so important to discuss it more openly. We talk about addiction, when it's okay to move on, and how she was able to put pen to paper on such an emotional topic. I will, of course, put all the links to Poorna's website, social media, and of course the book in the show notes on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and emmaguns.com. If you would like to get in touch with the show, please do email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com or slide into my DMs on social, where I'm at Emma Gunns. I genuinely adore hearing from you, and thank you to everyone who has been in touch recently. I've been getting quite a few messages and it's just been absolutely brilliant, and we're having some great conversations. Also, if you haven't already, you might like to join the private Facebook group for the show. The link is in the show notes, but that's where there's a lot of group chat about many things, including episodes and various other topics. Why not join the conversation? But here she is. I'll blather on no more. Here she is, the brilliant Poorna Bell on The Emma Gunn Show. Welcome, Poorna Bell. You say your name, you say it better than anyone.
Poorna.
Okay, we've just been having this conversation, listeners. It's got the most wonderful sort of lilt in the middle that I don't think I can get my mouth around properly.
So it's a very difficult name, one that I have had lots of problems with because I always have to spell it out. Like whenever I make a reservation, I always have to spell it out. Mm-hmm. And if I was to say Poorna to you, would you know how to spell it if you didn't know already how to do that?
I would use one O, not two. Poorna. Oh, God, but then you've got a whole other raft of issues.
Trust me. Yeah, been through all of that in school, all the variations.
Oh, no. Okay, right. Let's do this then. Nicknames. What on earth was it at school?
I think you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Porn is obviously a big one because most people pronounce my name Poorna. Mm-hmm. Poo, because I'm a 00, not a U or a 10. But Pooh is actually my nickname that my friends and family have for me. Mm-hmm. And I don't register it anymore. So it's not like I'm like, oh my God, they've actually just called me a pile of poo. And my mum's nickname for me is Pooh Bear. So it does kind of get quite
cute. Yeah, yeah.
The worst, however, is when someone knows me. So like, let's say they read my book and I refer to myself a couple of times as Pooh. Mm-hmm. And they then take it upon themselves to go, oh, hi, Pooh. And I'm like, no.
No, with nicknames, you have to have, not that conversation.
Permission giving.
There has to be consent.
Yeah.
There does. I don't know why I'm laughing at consent. But there does. There needs to be.
Yeah, there needs to be a conversation. Otherwise, it just gets very awkward. And it's like you've just shot the gun or moved a bit too quickly.
Yes. I remember calling my next door neighbour's daughter by her nickname. When we went around for like a barbecue years and years ago. And when I went home, my father said, you never use anyone, the nickname that someone else gives to someone unless that person has been.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. As someone whose nickname is Pooh, I can definitely vouch for that.
Well, I was just saying to Porna earlier that I am getting used to people calling me Guns because it feels a bit weird. I like it, but also, Caroline Hiron's got me an embossed travel wallet. And obviously I don't want to travel with it.
It's better than having poo embossed on it, let me tell you.
Going through airport security with an embossed wallet.
What's in that?
I don't think so.
Why is it not in a see-through bag?
I love it. It's one of my most cherished possessions. I have it in my handbag at all times, but I do think sometimes someone, next time I go to America, I'll have to leave it out because I don't want them thinking I'm part of the NRA.
It's a bit triggering at security, isn't it? It is. Literally.
Literally. But maybe that was what Caroline intended. No, I'm sure not. Anyway, we're here. I'm so delighted to be hanging out with you and chatting.
Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it's amazing.
We have so much to talk about today. And we're going to kick off with your book, Chase the Rainbow, which I finished reading this week. And I don't want this to sound ridiculous, but I needed to be still afterwards.
Someone said to me that they finished reading it and then they just needed to just put it down somewhere and like go for a walk for a little bit, which I'm very interested to actually find out more about that because obviously for me, that's not my experience of it. Like, I mean, I had to do some edits around it and so on and then basically didn't read it. I was like, I can't look at you for a few months until, you know, it was about to come out. And then periodically I do pick it up and read it, but I am very interested to hear how it affects other people.
So let's, in a nutshell, explain to the listeners. It's my top read so far of 2018, without a shadow of a doubt. It's beautifully constructed. It's very personal. You have a relationship with that book when you're reading it. So would you mind just describing for the listeners?
Sure. So the book is a memoir meets journalism of my life with my husband, Rob. So he passed away just over 3 years ago, actually, which just seems crazy because it does not feel like it's been 3 years. And he had depression. So he had chronic depression since he was, you know, quite young. And when we were married, I didn't know about this at the time because I was very, very naive around drug use. But he also was kind of secretly keeping a heroin addiction that he was kind of using to self-medicate his depression. Mm-hmm. But it also then turned into a rolling addiction, which he was trying to basically manage all of this stuff on his own. And then eventually things just came to a head. And the book culminates and then moves past. He took his own life in 2015. And for me, really, the summary of that entire book was to tell people, like, so if I told you, you know, in a nutshell, I was married, my husband passed away by suicide, you know, there are lots of assumptions that we make because of how things like suicide, addiction, mental illness is, you know, what our kind of cliff notes around those things are. And he was, like, obviously hugely complex. And there were, you know, difficult things that we had to deal with as a couple, mainly, you know, just him keeping an addiction for me, for example. But there was like an immense amount of love in our relationship. Mm. And he was an incredible human being. I mean, like one of the most, if not the most intelligent person I had ever come across. Hugely like, huge contradictions in that, like extremely gentle, you know, avid gardener, but also like a punk rocker. And I was like, I don't want people, or rather I don't want to go through life telling people anecdotally about what's happened to my husband or our story, and for them to kind of have this takeaway around it, which isn't actually a reflection of, for a lot of people who lose people to suicide and so on. So it was kind of, in one sense, it was a homage to him and like his legacy. But a big part of that legacy was also, if there was someone going through something similar, for them to not feel so isolated and alone in it. Because like that was a big part of my experience when we were going through this stuff, and subsequently after he passed away, which was that I felt very isolated and very alone in what I was feeling, and, you know, felt like it wasn't normal, like what I was going through and all of this stuff. So to be able to articulate that, and also just to do him and our relationship justice. So when you say it's, you know, a beautiful book, like that means so much, because that really is the portrayal of our relationship. And even though there were some really difficult bits to it, it was a beautiful relationship that we had.
It's very honest. It's very confronting. It's very, again, it's very beautifully written. And when I finished it, I put it down and I was sort of shuffling around afterwards, sort of like doing a bit of housework, sort of thinking. And then I just said to myself, I believe you. And I know that sounds like a really weird thing to say, but I read it and I thought, I totally imagine that if the circumstances were told from Rob's perspective, it would have been nothing but consistent. I feel like you were fair to all parties involved. If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that was definitely something that I thought about when I was writing it, which was, you know, we, our relationship was kind of 50-50 in terms of, you know, like how much you love each other. So there are some relationships we all know, like friends, where you can tell that one person is like blatantly more into the other person and you're just like, oh, don't hold on so tight. But like we, like for, like I described this to him actually, where I was like, there's an equilibrium. So it doesn't mean that one of us loves each other the more. It was a very equal kind of understanding and reciprocity of how much we loved each other. So when I was kind of going through it, I did try and bear in mind, you know, how would he think about this? And would he think it is an accurate representation of our relationship? So that actually was quite a good steer and a good guiding point. But at the same time, I didn't want to make it seem like I was like whitewashing some of like the difficult bits of our relationship, because I just felt that, you know, we did speak about this when he was alive, but there was a lot of like very bad decision making that Rob made, and just generally, you know, an inability to not keep making the same mistakes, even though he had been given over and over again the permission to just I just said to him kind of very consistently, it's okay if you kind of mess up or if you relapse or if you do whatever it is, but just tell me. Like the worst thing actually is not telling me. But unfortunately, he never kind of got to that point. I think he was always just very petrified that if I kind of found out, I would just leave. And
but what I think is very interesting is you always knew anyway. Once you knew. You always knew.
Like, I mean, I have a letter that he wrote me. This was very shortly after, I think, his second relapse, where he was like, you know, like, we both know that you know, but without treating me like a child, like, he's literally written that, like, without treating me like a child, how are you supposed to move forward with anything? Because I keep denying it. So that's also, that was also immensely frustrating because it wasn't like I was dealing with someone who was constantly in denial. Like he had a very crystal clear understanding of what a nightmare he could be sometimes, which actually obviously was immensely frustrating for me because I'm like, you understand in certain moments, you do understand like what it is like for me. But obviously there's just, it's so complicated and there's all this other stuff swirling around.
So complicated. And I think you do all those elements justice. I found it very eye-opening.
That's, well, it was meant to be. If you didn't know anything about that, it was meant to be eye-opening, but hopefully eye-opening in a good way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I'm really glad to hear that, because it was also just that, like, it's a trickle-down effect, right? In that, okay, you may not have someone who is immediately in your life who is going through that kind of stuff, but you might know someone who knows someone. And actually being able to, like, impart that information so that it kind of helps someone else figure out, like, the mess that they're in. Whereas maybe before you didn't know how that kind of stuff works, like, that was actually a really big motivation for writing the book.
And I just wondered how you began, because, and listeners know this, I've sat down to write books and it never comes. And even if something, you know, even if 5,000 words do make it onto my laptop, I will then read someone else's work and think, no, I should structure it differently, or it should be this format. Oh, I'll do it as emails. I'll do it in conversation. And I end up just killing my own creativity. Did it come quite naturally?
Yeah. I mean, there's no... the thing is, being very honest about it, if it had been a struggle, I wouldn't have written it, because it would have been a sign that I was either not emotionally or psychologically ready to write it. But the one, like, godsend, I would say, because it's really, really helped me with my grief, especially in the first year, which was just, like, a phenomenally awful year when I look back on it, was that writing was very easy. And also it just, it was one of the very few things that kind of gave me any sense of comfort, because it meant that I was able to talk about him and write about him in a space where in my day to day, I didn't really feel like I could do that. And not because people weren't supportive, but you can't really do that. You kind of have to get on with your job, or you hang out with people. And yes, you can have people that you talk to about what's going on, but writing, like, gave me full license to be able to do that and not hold back. And I think with the book, when I knew what I was writing, which was specifically our story, it was kind of incredible. Like, the beginning bits of recalling, like, the first days of our relationship and that kind of stuff was immensely comforting, actually. And the hardest bit was definitely writing about his death. And that took me, like, 3 weeks, like, compared to, bearing in mind, I had 4 months to finish the book. Like, that took, that, like, one chapter or half of a chapter took, like, an incredibly long time. But I was very keen to have a style of writing and a book that was out there, which was not a book that was currently out there at the moment. And I wanted it to be the book that I wished that I'd had when he was alive. So all of that kind of just coalesced to give me a very strong guiding point. But yeah, majorly it was about the comfort. Like, it gave me a huge amount of relief, actually. Like, people say it's cathartic, and yeah, it's cathartic, but, like, writing a book about stuff is no more cathartic than actually, like, physically and emotionally going through a grief process like that personally.
Yeah, and writing a book is also, I know many authors, it's quite complex. There's a lot of back and forth, and deadlines are quite stressful. So how long... So it was published in 2017.
Yeah, but I wrote it in 2016.
Yes.
Yeah. But, and because of when we wanted the book to come out and so on, yeah, there wasn't a whole load of time to write it. But it was also, like, I was hugely, like, antisocial around that time. So I knew I kind of needed to... So my sister always used to, like, check in on me. And she was like, how many people have you seen this week, especially? And I'd be like, I went to a shop. And she was like, yeah, that doesn't really count. So, like...
Baristas and post office workers. Baristas and post office workers. That's who I speak to.
They still count. They're people.
Exactly.
But yeah, so it basically gave me permission to just go, nope, sorry, I can't go to your birthday or your this or your that, because I had obviously a very busy day job, which was like a Monday to Friday jobby. And then the weekends were when I was writing the book. So actually it allowed me to just completely remove myself from, like, my social circle, not in a bad way, but just as in I just got to escape a little bit. And kind of, you know, to kind of potter around at home and to do more writing and go for a run. And that was okay because I was still doing something productive.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I was just kind of, you know, under a blanket watching Netflix, which I do.
Yeah, no judgment here.
Yeah.
But there's something about that. There's something about actually sometimes with drawing, and I do think it tends to be a lot of creative people that I've spoken to say that actually withdrawing sometimes is the kindest thing they can do for themselves. I find socializing quite draining physically.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, draining. God, yeah.
And I love hanging out with my friends, but I have to be quite measured.
Yeah.
And when you're going, if I'm going through a this is where it gets tricky. Mm. There's that fine balance of withdrawing and it being unhealthy and you actually cutting people off and there being a time where you're withdrawing because actually you just need to recharge because they both look the same to the outside world.
So I would 100% agree with you. And sometimes when I've got the balance wrong, like by the end of like, I don't know, day three of not seeing anyone, I've just gone completely bonkers and I will call someone up and they're like, have you been doing meth? Like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you talking so quickly? But so and at that point I'm like, oh, okay. So for me personally, I know that 2 days is my cutoff, and whether or not I like it, on that third day, I need to go and actually see someone who knows me. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Emma, baristas and shopkeepers don't count. So it needs to be someone who knows me, who I can have a conversation with beyond, oh, hi, mate, how you doing? And shut the door in their face. But the withdrawing stuff, I'm sure that you get this because, you know, if you use social media, or you, you know, have a busy working life or whatever, people are quite surprised to know that there is a big part of you that needs to sequester yourself away. Or like, I call myself like a semi-hermit. You know, I need to have a specific amount of time where I'm not socializing with people. And it's like, my sister lives in Geneva, and every time I go and visit her and her husband and my niece, you know, they always used to do this thing where like they'd have a party, okay, for one of these days and invite people over. And the last time I went to visit them, they were like, oh, well, shall we invite? And I said, look, we need to have a talk. I said, your mates are lovely, but I can't do it, okay? I said, I would not be doing this in my life back in London. I was like, two people max. I need to vet these people before. But I was like, I need to vet these people before. And they were like, we had no idea. And I'm like, but now, so now it's great. So I'm going to go visit them in a few weeks. And they're like, we know that, you know, you're a bit sensitive around people. And it's like, no, I'm not sensitive around people. I have to like measure out the amount of myself that I spend with people.
Yes. I get too bug-eyed otherwise because I've got, particularly like we met at a very intimate screening of Deadpool 2.
Yes, we did.
And we were in the bar beforehand and I found that really overwhelming. And I was like, I think I'm doing the bug-eyed thing where I'm just trying to take everything in. And the only way I can physically do that other than nodding is just to make my eyes as wide as possible to look like I'm paying attention. So I call it my bug-eyed thing.
Yeah. The thing is, I think people must think I have a bladder problem because like I think I went to the loo like 10 times that night maybe. And it's just because like I'm not doing anything in the loo, like anything like
just taking dodgy.
I'm just like kind of, you know, just like hanging out by the sink, playing around with the hand lotion. No, wait, that sounded so wrong.
But it's stealing hotel soap.
Yeah. Just decanting it into like my Muji bottle. No, it's
I should think of that.
Yeah. But it's just, it's almost like I need to kind of, I have to factor those because I don't smoke anymore. I'm like an ex-smoker, so I don't have the luxury of doing that.
I love that section in your book where you're in hospital with your mum and dad and they're like, do you smoke? Have you ever been a smoker? And you're like, yeah, for like 8 years. Full description of like what you smoked when, what your budget was. Like just imagine your parents' face.
And all the brand names. Yeah, no, they're such hypocrites though. Like my dad, I swear I'm not making this up. Or maybe, you know how your memory just gets a bit wonky. I swear he used to be on like 60 Rothmans a day before he quit. And he still has his like very like, when he talks about smoking, he's like got this far away look.
It's misty.
Like an ex-wife who he really misses. And we're just like, okay, Dad. And he was like, I swear to God, if there was a cigarette in my hand right now. And you're like, you have to change the subject really quickly because really it's just very uncomfortable.
Let's talk about fresh air and healthy living.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, hotel bathrooms, I know what you mean. I think you should start incorporating an outfit chain because I was thinking, You can take yourself off, but you should be like when like a major recording artist is doing a concert and they go off stage and they come off back with like a different look.
Yeah, a different outfit.
I think
yeah,
we start incorporating maybe. That. Speaking of which, and I am going off on a slight tangent here, but only because it's at the front of my mind, weirdly. Whitney, did you see the movie?
No, I am going to. I saw the poster for it and I am going to see it though. But have you seen it?
Presumably? I saw it on Monday night. Okay. I self-medicate with films. Well, it's very beautifully constructed, no doubt about it. Yeah. And the access that he's got to the family, this is the filmmaker, Kevin MacDonald, is really incredible. And there's a big revelation in the movie that I won't spoil here. But when at the end of those documentaries, they flash up a screen that says, blah, 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 happened. When that came up, I said, oh, I hope this is just leading into something else. But it wasn't. It was the end. I felt like it presented a patchwork. And then I went home immediately and watched the Nick Broomfield documentary. And the reason why I wanted to talk to you about it was because it's basically the depiction of addiction and mental health in mainstream media. And I felt very guilty about what my thoughts and feelings have been about towards Whitney Houston at the end of her life.
Yeah.
Because I probably had forgotten what an incredible talent she is. And I probably had sort of relegated her to kind of the tabloid, problems with a funny look on my face, and then you move on to something else. And it made me realise it's so irresponsible to the people around us, whether you know them or not, to be so disparaging of those issues. They're massive.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when those pictures, I can't remember how many years ago this was, but I remember this story. One of the tabloids had gotten hold of pictures of her and Bobby Brown's home. Do you remember?
The bathroom.
Yeah, the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I can still see the sink, like, as I'm talking to you in my mind. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, how could this happen? You know, this is disgusting. She has a child, blah, blah, blah. Very judgmental and very, but also, you know, the way that we report around stuff like that, I mean, I don't know if it's gotten hugely better, was there's no context to it. It was literally like, this is a picture of her bathroom. Look at, like, basically look
pipe.
At, look at the crack pipe. Look at, like, this complete shambles of a human or whatever. And like, when I was going through all of this stuff with Rob, like basically when I knew what was kind of going on, before I knew, I was hugely judgmental about drug use. So for example, he knew a lady who was a heroin addict who had two kids. And I remember saying to him, I can't believe, like, how could she still use if she's got two kids? And I didn't know he was obviously using at the time. But he was like, look, you know, if you can, just try not to judge her too harshly. Because, like, I just remember thinking, ugh, you know, I don't know what he's talking about or whatever. Then when I kind of went through this whole, like, thing around his recovery with him, whether that was listening to him talk about his own experiences and what was going on in his head and so on. I mean, Emma, it completely changed, like, everything that I knew about what addiction was like and so on. And just also why people use, like, why they can't stop, like, how important context was to all of this stuff. I thought about it and I just thought, you know, why did I not know this? Like, or why did I hold that point of view? And it is, unfortunately, because very often, you know, whether you're at school, like, I remember being taught about drugs when I was at school, and it was done in this very, like, drugs are very bad and if you do them, you will die. Which, okay, yes, like, those are two things that are kind of true. But it doesn't tell you anything about, like, the nuance of it, or how someone could kind of, like, get in that position, or, like, how they work, or, like, how they affect the brain, or why, for example, I don't know, like, heroin is, like, a classic drug in that there's no specific, like, talk to any, like, expert, there's no specific economic background, whatever it is, like, race. You know, there's no predisposition. It's not genetic like alcoholism is. So that should kind of tell you something about, like, how it possibly affects people and how people get hooked on it. But we don't know any of that information. So you kind of go from this very, like, top level, people who do drugs are bad. They could stop, but they choose not to. Like, choice is obviously, you know, huge word in this. They choose not to. Conclusion, they must be very bad and selfish people.
Yeah.
And that's that's hugely problematic because like most of us will know someone who struggles with addiction of some kind.
Well, I feel like we bandy around the word addicted, addiction and addict really casually now. Yeah. I've written features about am I addicted to my smartphone? But that, in it, does it take away the strength of that word? I mean, obviously addiction applies to anything that you can't stop doing or have become dependent upon. But does that water it down? Like, do you think the fact that we use it for such sort of everyday...
I mean, smartphone addiction is an interesting one because that, I think, is actually a thing. Like, so, for example, there's a hospital in London that actually does a recovery program around addiction to technology or your smartphone or whatever, which to you or me, we might view it. And I guess maybe this is the way to look at like alcoholism. We're like, we kind of project our own experience on what someone else who actually has a much bigger problem might be going through. But like, let's say if you have a technology or a smartphone addiction or a gaming addiction, right? To the point where you aren't leaving your house, you're not engaging with people, you are incapable of having like actual legitimate human relationships with other people. That actually kind of is the basis of what addiction is. Like whether it's like, you know, I don't know, alcohol addiction, which can be hugely chaotic because impacts like people's behaviors to a drug like heroin where you actually probably if you as long as you had like regular access to it you could probably be an addict and completely like function normally in society and no one would really know because your behavior isn't as chaotic but obviously the sort of the other side to it is you're probably not socializing with people you're probably quite isolated and so all of those behaviors I think you can definitely attribute to an addictive behavior. But I do agree. Like, I do think, you know, like I was talking about like Linda McCartney. Sorry, I'm going to laugh. And I don't mean to like trivialize it.
But like, I said
I'm addicted to Linda McCartney sausages. Now, am I really like, if a day or a week went by, yes, I had them yesterday before you judge me. But like, if I had a week where, I don't know, my supermarket didn't stock them. Would that be a bad week? Yes. Would it literally mean I had to call some like dodgy person up to deliver some sausages to me? It's a completely different thing. So you're right. I think we should probably like measure how we use it as a word.
Yes.
Because I also think especially around like alcoholism, like my God, like, you know, I see people in complete denial about like loved ones who are alcoholics, like, oh, they have a slight problem or because it's not theirs to have to manage or like, let's say their alcoholism is like a bit like low level, but it's still alcoholism. But because like alcohol is kind of more accepted, I just don't think we really give it the seriousness that it is due. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it's so socially acceptable to have a drink, and it's socially acceptable to be drunk.
Yes.
And it's socially acceptable to be hungover.
Yeah.
And we were having this conversation before we started recording. I feel as though teetotalism is in my future, but I just, because I cannot fathom. It feels like for me, as someone who works for myself, I already work 6 days a week, sometimes seven, doing all of my content. I sometimes, and to lose a day to a hangover, I just imagine my accountant just coming in and going, idiot.
Yes.
Idiot.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. I have like a summer drinks thing on Tuesday. And in my head, I already know that I'm going to have to back out of it because I can't afford to lose a Wednesday. Like, I just can't afford that time. And the idea of, and actually this is what some of it does. It robs you of time in which you could actually be doing amazing stuff that you really enjoyed doing. Yeah. I don't know that I've got that balance right yet though.
No, I haven't. And when I'm functioning well, like when I'm working out, when I'm eating right, like that's when all the good stuff falls into place. So then I have to not give myself a hard time if I do have a drink. Because actually, again, because it's socially acceptable, I then have that you know, devil and angel on my shoulder saying, you deserved a night out with your friends. But I find it very, very confusing, conflicting, complicated topic.
Well, I don't know what kind of drinker you are, but when I was sort of talking to a friend of mine, this is when I kind of made a definitive choice just to drink less. And she was like, you know, but why don't you just have like one or two? And I was like, what? We would not be having this conversation if I was the type of person that had the restraint to go, oh yeah, I'm only going to have one and then just jog on home. I was like, obviously we've gotten to the point where I don't know, like I got a taxi and tried to pay my taxi driver in euros and have lost a shoe that has like brought me to this point where I'm like, maybe I should like not drink as much or my drinking can be problematic in certain circumstances. And I'm also very easily led. So if someone else is like, whippity-doo, let's like order another bottle of wine. I'm like, yeah, that sounds amazing.
I have to be with someone who's better at it than me.
Absolutely, yeah.
In order to not, because I would be, I'm the sort of person when someone says, oh, should we have another one? In my head, I'm going, yeah. But then I'm sussing out all of the non-verbal cues in the body language and that, will they judge me if I say yes?
Yeah.
It's just like, then I think, if you just want another drink, have another drink. But it's about, it's about how it makes you feel.
Yeah. And that gets, I mean, the older I get, the higher that price seems to be. And I just remember like when I, my last team that I managed, you know, are fairly younger than me and in their 20s. And they're just like, oh, but why do you have to go home? And I'm like, because I do not have as many electrolytes as you do. You're going to be fine, sunshine. It's going to take me 3 days to get over this. So, yeah.
Yeah, it just isn't worth it. And in the moment, you know, it's so complicated. Yeah, so I do find that. So I find that we have, I think it's a good thing that we bandy the word addiction around because it is opening up these sorts of conversations. And these sorts of conversations can only be a good thing, whether that's talking about addiction and taking away the idea of a heroin addict being what you used to see in the movies.
Yeah. Oh, God. It's like Trainspotting.
Yeah. Yes. It's like, oh, the typical heroin story is always high flyer, then, you know, on the streets, no teeth. And it's, it's very stark because that makes good movies.
Yeah.
But also, I grew up in the 80s and every movie where you were mugged, it was a particular kind of young man in a hoodie. There were all these stereotypes that we've kind of, what are they called? The cues, the subtle cues that actually mean that when you're dealing with real life situations, you're potentially adding that layer of interpretation on, which is completely incorrect.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when I was, my agent and I were looking for publishers for the book, and one publisher who we didn't end up going with, you know, one of the questions that she asked me was like, how could you not know? I mean, okay, I'm saying it as if it's like an interrogation. She didn't like use that tone, but it basically was like, how could you not know that your husband had a heroin addiction for 3 years while you were married and you didn't know? And I'm like, because I don't know what a heroin addiction looks like, not having done heroin or like being ever taught about it in school or whatever. So I didn't know like what the symptoms were. And also like a lot of it was masked by his depression. So like when I thought things were just really odd, he would kind of say, oh, I'm just quite depressed at the moment. And also it's impossible to extricate that because he was actually obviously depressed. But the other thing was that my view of a heroin addict was exactly those stereotypes. And having spoken to like a ton of like drug experts about it, you know, so I spoke to like David Nutt, who is like one of the like leading drugs experts in the UK. And he basically said, look, like there was once upon a time in the UK that opiates or heroin wasn't illegal, but you could actually get it. So you could kind of, I think I'm probably going to get this wrong, but there was a way in which if you were an addict, you could use it and it would be okay because you could still function and like do a job and so on. And I'm not, and sorry, that sounds like I'm advocating it, but what I'm trying to say is that if you were someone who happened to be an addict, you could still manage to have like a functioning life. And then they kind of completely changed the policies and the rules around it so that what ended up happening or what ends up happening is when you're thinking of that guy who's going to snatch your handbag or whatever is basically someone who is a heroin user who cannot get heroin to stop himself and his body from being, or herself, from being sick. Mm-hmm. So heroin causes a sickness unlike any other type mm-hmm. of drug. So yes, you could, and in some cases, yes, you know, it is kind of understandable to moralize it and say, well, that person has turned to a life of crime to get mm-hmm. drugs. But why are they using those drugs? Like, they're not using them because they're like, you know, jetting off to a party. They're using it because they don't really want to be sick. Mm. And so for me, that was like a really big understanding, in that there is like a swathe of like of opiate users who continue to use opiates because they don't really want to be ill. And I'm just like, I had no way of knowing that, because for me, a heroin user or an opiate user mm. was like, you know,
getting high.
Yeah,
as opposed to managing away from,
or injecting or whatever. Mm. Yeah, and definitely like getting high and, you know, hanging out with their mates. Mm. And I'm like, but actually, like, heroin users are like notoriously solitary. Mm. And also, like, yeah, like if you saw Rob, like he was, you know, like cooking dinner for me and working away and doing other things. So, like, how was I ever supposed to like piece that together?
And also, there's a very secretive element to.
Oh God, yeah.
To heroin in particular.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
yeah. And yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt
no,
you.
No,
just
no.
Coming back to the sort of different, it's that sickness thing. It was just, I remembered, I listened to an interview with Kevin Smith, the, you know who Kevin yeah. Smith is, the writer and filmmaker, and Jason Mewes, Jay.
Oh, yeah.
Was on heroin for a long time. I think I'm getting that right. And
yeah.
And he was like, you know, you can't be unsympathetic to a heroin user and just be like, well, just stop doing it, because that doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
And then I think Kevin Smith was saying that he spoke to one of Jay's doctors, and he described the sickness to him. And he said, you know, pins and needles, it's like that, but throughout your entire body.
Yeah.
And even that just made me shudder when I heard yeah. it, the idea of it.
Yeah. I mean, and also it's not like the sickness is like awful, I imagine. But I also saw Rob going through it. So mm-hmm. I kind of know that it was awful. Unbearable is how a lot of people would describe it. And I went on a lot of drugs forums to try and like find out what it was like to make mm-hmm. sense of it. But once that kind of sickness had passed, like he showed me some notes that he wrote to his doctor, because he needed to kind of get some sleeping pills to help with some of the insomnia around it. Was that once the physical withdrawal had finished, like the mental withdrawal was just unlike anything, any other drug that you would have ever known about or dealt with. And just basically that was the thing that just kept pulling him back in that trying to deal with all of that. Mm-hmm. And also because, like, obviously, if you are an addict for a number of years, there is a hell of a lot of shame that you have accumulated. So that kind of then just all comes crashing down mm-hmm. in addition to whatever it was that you were using to kind of numb, you know, to numb yourself, in that you could kind of function in the world. Mm-hmm. And some people might say that that's a very self-indulgent way of looking at it. But I feel that it kind of points to the fact that we are not necessarily that great mm-hmm. as a society at being able to address all of that stuff like quite early on. So you end up getting someone who's basically an adult mm. who just doesn't really know how to cope or deal with it in any other way. And you and I might sit here and go, well, you just kind of like get on with it. But I didn't have the same mental health issues that Rob did, or, you know, so how on earth am I supposed to be able to apply what I would do in a situation when we're not on an even playing field mm-hmm. when it comes to addiction? I think that's what everyone does. Like, they're like, well, I wouldn't do it. And it's like, okay, but you're not the same person mm-hmm. and you may not have had the same issues. So I think it's like, why, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like someone offering you a canapé and someone saying, oh yeah. And someone else saying, I'm not hungry, I've just eaten.
Yeah.
Like, you're coming at it from yeah. canapés. I can't believe I yeah. brought it back to canapés. But it's, you can't, obviously, as yeah. you say. And also in the book, you talked about trying to find resources to help you.
Yeah.
Once you realised that you were actually helping somebody with a drug addiction, in addition to depression, you struggle to find resources.
It was so bad. I mean, I found that on the one hand, I was really glad that there seemed to be quite a lot of resources out there for someone who, I mean, this may have changed because this is a few, we're talking about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But there seemed to be a lot of resources, for example, to help Rob. And I was like, okay, well, this is great. And I'm very glad that he's supported. However, I have to, A, maintain this complete facade in front of most of my friends and family. And I have to go to work in addition to like dealing with all of this stuff that's going on at home. So like, how the hell am I supposed to do that without completely going mad? Because I need someone to talk to about this and try to find a support group, which was very slim pickings, and my own borough didn't do it. So I had to like drive like 30 minutes on a Saturday morning or 40 minutes to get to a different like borough. And that was amazing while it lasted. But we then moved to a completely different part of London where they only had like one support group and they were just complete assholes. Like they just dealt with it so badly. And the entire like vibe of the place was just to be very suspicious of your loved one. So basically the premise of the group was if you had a loved one who struggled with addiction, this was a place you could come and talk to about what was going on. And I went to one session, and unlike this other amazing support group that I had been to in Lewisham, this was like, you know, some woman was really paranoid that her husband was going to relapse. He was an alcoholic. And the guy running the group basically was feeding that paranoia. And I remember coming home and like Rob said to me, you know, hey, like, how did the group go? Was it okay? And I just burst into tears. And I was like, the group was really bad and I forgot my backpack there, so I have to go back. And he was like, and I should have like twigged this. He was like, no, listen, you don't worry. I will go back and get your backpack. And I was like, oh, thanks, hon. I was like, thank you so much for doing that. And then later on the following day, I get a call from the group going, the group leader going, I'm really sorry, but you will not be able to come back to this group. I was like, I wanted to say mofo. I was not going to come back anyway, but I was like, just out of interest, why? And he was like, because your husband came, called me the C word, and took your backpack and then left. And like, I just texted Rob and I was like, what did you do? This was like the only support group. And he was like, he's just sent this amazing message. And he was like, I'm really sorry, but no one makes my tough wife cry and gets away with it. Aww. And I was just like, oh, and like it wasn't, on the one hand, it was like unbelievably sweet of him. Yes, I didn't plan to go back to that support group, but it did like hit home that like, I was like, I literally don't know where to go now. Like, I don't know how to get support around this. And then I think I just got a therapist in the end because I was just like, I don't really know. Mm. Like, there's no kind of, there seems to be no money coming in from the government to like support the loved ones of addicts, which is really mad because you're the one bringing home the money and like creating a stable environment for them.
Which is why it's interesting that one of the first things you said about the book is it's the book that I wish I'd had when I was going through this.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you can't create government funding. You can do as much campaigning as you want, but ultimately you have created a resource for somebody. Have you had anyone, and as a journalist, we get onto your body of work. I said it to you earlier and I'll say it again. I wrote it in my notes. You write the kind of stuff that adds value to the world.
Thank you, Emma.
No, but you do. The topics you cover in your Twitter feed, everyone needs to follow you because you'll be like looking for people with, you know, experience of such and such. And it's and every time I see one of those, I think, well, I'm not quite right for that one. But when I am, you wait. But basically, it's the kind of stuff, and with each and every one, which is why I keep coming back to it, is it's the kind of thing that will be a helpful resource to somebody. And so it makes complete sense that that was one of your strongest motivating factors in writing the book.
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
And I love the fact that the book is called Chase the Rainbow. And it doesn't have a... what am I trying to say? Like a headline, grabbing, scary. It's beautiful, and the book looks nice as well.
Yeah, thanks.
But do you know what I mean? It was all of that intended as well.
Well, so originally, and this was a fight that I did win. The publisher wanted it to be called something with a colon of And this was one woman's or one man. And I said, no. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, okay, don't get me wrong. When I show you the paperback, that does have it on there. But it's done in a way that I feel does the book justice. Mm-hmm. But I was like, in the first, like, for the hardback, I was like, I don't want it to have that because it's very important that there was journalism that was part of that memoir. Mm-hmm. And I, like, interviewed people to kind of just bolster some of the questions actually that I had after mm. Rob passed away, and I just needed an authority around it. And I think what I had, you know, I've been in journalism for about, 15 years and have seen like or worked across lots of different types and ways and means of journalism. But what I think the book taught me about, and obviously subsequently writing about it, is that I think in journalism we have a danger of sometimes reporting about things, especially like life related things, in a very particular type of way. So we're used to seeing, you know, oh, the headline has to be salacious, otherwise mm-hmm. people won't read it. And I'm sorry, but that's absolute bollocks.
Mm, it is.
Like, the strength of your story lies in how you tell it, and you can tell it in a way that is neutral, that doesn't shaft the person that is telling you the story. Which, you know, I mean, like, when I tell people, so I've started dating, when I tell people I'm a journalist, they're like, oh, you know, like, yeah. Because there's no trust there, because mm-hmm. they've seen what has happened in journalism. And I'm not talking about all of the stuff that's necessarily come out as part of the Levinson inquiry. It's more also, they don't trust journalists to take their story and actually do something noble with it. Mm. And what I've kind of figured out is there is, like, don't get me wrong, like, there's a definite balance of how you do it. But I think that type of journalism is something I'm really interested in, or writing in general, of like someone telling me or me telling someone's story, which may have been a story that I had no idea about, that shines kind of like a little torchlight mm. into a, you know, their corner of the world. And A, educates me about something, I don't know. So for example, like what it's like to be asexual or never having fallen in love or mm. whatever that might be. But also there might be someone else reading it who's just like, oh yeah, that's me. Like, I didn't know that. And so mm. now there's a story where it actually reflects my opinions or my lifestyle in a way that's kind of great. And it's mm. not done in a way that makes me feel ashamed or weird or whatever it is about it. Like,
yeah.
I've learned that there's a space for that. And I think that's something like I'm very wholeheartedly into.
It's a tough space to, it's a tough space.
It is. Yeah.
Because you're right. clickbait.
Yeah.
All of that kind of stuff. Listicles. Yeah. But actually thoughtful, composed pieces.
Yeah.
Are sort of few and far between.
Well, I feel I'm giving you like a false impression. Like, I do really still like I don't write them, but I love reading them. Listicles.
Yeah.
And like, I communicate like with my sister, like predominantly in GIFs and like memes.
Oh, absolutely. This is my life.
Yeah.
But I like, yeah. but I like the long read.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I watched Whitney and I had lots of feelings.
Yeah.
And then I sort of exchanged a few messages with Terry White and mm. we were like, yeah, it's extraordinary. And I thought, but there's something that I can't quite put my finger on.
Yeah.
Enter Simran Hans, the film critic, who just nails every single thought and mm. feeling on the head. And yeah. now I'm like, how many times can I direct message her before she blocks me?
Have you checked today? Has she blocked you?
No, because I haven't opened the discussion yet.
Okay.
So, you know, I want to be on my A game. But anyway, going through something like this, mm. writing a book about it, and then doing podcasts with someone like me,
yeah.
How are you able to own this place, make it a positive space, move the story forward, meaning move the discussion mm. of addiction and depression forward, but not be defined by it?
So to answer kind of the first part of your question, mm. I guess, so for me, I gravitate towards writing, especially when it's writing around grief or like whether it's suicide or addiction. I gravitate to writing that moves me, but is also quite like unsentimental in how it talks about things. Mm. So there's a way to craft something that really could be poignant and touches people, but also to talk about it like in a way where you have got a bit of your humor in it. So for example, like for me, humor was a really big part of how I have gotten through my grieving process. And it's obviously like in the book. After I did the first round of press for this, I was a bit worried of just like, oh my God, like, you know, what does this mean? And I don't really want to be pigeonholed for always being an advocate for this kind of stuff. I will probably always be an advocate because there are just not many people in that space. But I think it's about the different kind of work or the different types of work that I do. So for example, there are people out there who only write about their own experience. So the danger around pigeonholing would have been if I had come out with this book and then that's all that I did. So if I only did like books that were, you know, about, I don't know, like grief or suicide or addiction or whatever, in the years to come, then I can kind of understand that that would then end up becoming this thing that I am defined by. But I have just learned that, like, if I expand what I'm doing in terms of my repertoire and what I write about, so for example, women's empowerment is something, or women's journalism is a huge, huge part of what I do. And that is no less important than like the mental health, you know, writing that I do. But I can, I think I can kind of do both. And I think I need, yeah, like I absolutely kind of need to tell myself that it's important to do that. Because also like this stuff is kind of, not this podcast, because that would be rude of me, but it can be exhausting. Like I remember like after the first round of press for Chase the Rainbow, like I had to like not talk to anyone or do anything like that for about a week. Like as in, you know, or just not think about it and not deal with it. And in a good way in that, like I just didn't want to go on radio or whatever because it does take a lot. Like it's like stuff like this doesn't take, it's not emotionally exhausting, but like if I was to go like and do an hour's panel and talk about mental health and for men, for example, I will then need to go immediately home and have a very quiet evening and just kind of nurture myself a little bit. And what that tells me is that this isn't something that I can do full time, nor would I kind of want to, because I don't think that that's particularly good for me. But my life is also moving on. And so whatever that looks like in terms of, you know, what I'm doing work-wise or whether like I'm seeing other people or whatever, I love Rob and I am always passionate to kind of talking about and dedicating a portion of my life to talking about things that will help other people. But I am probably not going to do that full time because I don't think that any particular life event, whether it's something as huge as a death or something, you know, small like losing a job, I don't think that you should let things like that define you, because people die like all the time. Like people will continue to die in my lifetime of people that I know. And the kind of has to be a way for me to figure out how to kind of mourn that in an appropriate way. Give comfort maybe to other people when I feel able to, but then to just sort of put it on the shelf that it needs to be put on, revisit it from time to time in my own private way, but then to kind of move forward.
This is a big question. So we can, you know, go into it in whichever way is comfortable. How does one move on? Brackets or like parentheses. Do you give yourself permission? Do you instinctively know when the time is right if you try to do it too soon? Is it, does it make the situation worse?
So there is a lot of trial and error that I have undertaken during the last 3 years. Like, so one, definitely I have tried things where I've moved on or done things too quickly. So for example, you know, had gone to a celebration of a sort where I thought I would be completely fine and actually really needed to remove myself from there. Or like even stuff like going to work on a day when I knew I should have worked from home, but I went to work and then basically like started crying at the like top of the road and then just needed to turn around and get back on the train again. And all of that stuff I view as just being incredibly valuable because it's teaching me that there is this other massive part of me that isn't conscious and isn't present all the time because it's kind of like ticking away in the background. But from time to time, it will put its hand up and go, Purna, you know what? This is just not quite the right thing for you to be doing. And I've learned to like kind of heed that part of me a lot more than I probably used to do before. But generally, I have found that people have the best intentions and will try and give advice around maybe where I should be or what I should be doing and so on. And in some instances, it has literally been a game changer in terms of giving me a soft little nudge to like to move on. So for example, I was living in the flat that Rob and I lived in for about a year and a half after he passed away, or about a year after he passed away. And I just said to my best mate, you know what, like, I feel like maybe I should think about possibly moving. And she said it in a very gentle way, but she said, I definitely think you should think about moving. Like, you know, that would be a good thing for you. And it just kind of, that was the push that I needed. On the other hand, when people have told me, you know, oh, are you sure you're not like, you know, making it harder for yourself? Are you sure? I'm like, if I was not on the phone to you and if you were in front of me right now, I would like garrote you with my own shoelace. Because like, honestly, like, what do you know about my situation? Like, has this, like, this sounds really harsh, but it's like, did this literal thing happen to you? If it didn't, like, I do not want to hear like stuff like, are you making it harder? So it's also learning to listen that everyone will have advice for what you should be doing, but it's really working out like what's, and I have learned, also learned that the hard way. I think with dating, for example, I felt like I should be doing it because maybe it would mean that I wasn't so broken by the entire experience. And I can say that in retrospect. Obviously, there was no way I was like this articulate when I was going through it, running around like, you know, downloading Tinder and then like deleting it and throwing my phone into the bin. but like when I actually did go on a date, it was because I was ready to. So it wasn't like, because I think someone asked me, you know, did you feel slightly weird or did you feel guilty or like you were cheating on Rob? Or, and they didn't say it in a, again, the tone was very like genuine and very like inquiring. But I was like, no, like I didn't feel any of those things because I actually waited until it was the right time. And then kind of like went into dating. And then when I haven't wanted to date, I don't date. So it's just very much what I would say to answer your bigger question around moving on. I think it's that learning to live with your grief in a way where it doesn't overwhelm you all the time as it does or as it did for me in like the first year where I was literally like always, I felt like I was like two steps away from like losing it. And so I would just kind of try and hold it together as much as I can. And what I've just done is it's a mixture of lots of different things. So it's that spending time on my own. It's saying no to a hell of a lot of stuff that people expect you to do. Or like, even if that's like staying later at parties. And I'm like, no, like I am going home because that's what I need to do for me. But you stay and like, you know, do whatever. And it's also, I think, just making very powerful decisions for myself. So first year, I couldn't make any decisions. Also because I was like pretty depressed for like half of it. But after that kind of fog passed a little bit, it was about thinking in a gentle way, what does my future look like and how would I like it to look like? So not something lame like, which is what people want for me, I'm afraid, is like, will I meet someone again? Like that is such a bad, terrible goal. Like whether or not you have been through what I've been through or whatever it is, like building your happiness or your future around this unknown person for me is not something that I can do. It's not something I'm not willing to trade away my present for this fairy tale future that I am supposed to be having. It's total bullshit.
I want to leap across this sofa and hold you.
There are too many cushions.
There are. They're very comfortable.
Thank you.
That is completely and utterly the words that I'll be stealing from you. You're many of the words I should be stealing, but I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah.
People wanting you to tether yourself to something that doesn't exist yet or isn't something that you can control is, for me as an independent, you know, a woman who makes my own living.
Yeah.
I sometimes find it insulting for people. I know different circumstances completely, but I just, when people say that that's what they want for me, I think, what about what I'm doing now? It's pretty awesome, actually. Screw
you.
I get a bit defensive.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think God, that's like totally natural, because I think that that person doesn't realize they're doing it. But by saying that kind of stuff, by default, you feel like your life and your achievements are not recognized because you don't have that thing that they're saying you should be going for. And also, like, I've kind of tried it, not in terms of like going, I'll be very honest with you, not in terms of like going for a relationship or like seriously dating people, but it's more like when I've kind of thought about it, I'm just like, actually, it's just, I thought about it very strongly last year, because like, you know, 99% of my mates are like married and have kids, and I kind of went a bit batshit, and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, I know that like I am not going to be where they are in a year, in like possibly 2 years, 3 years. And also, like, but that made me feel really uncomfortable inside, like as in very upset, because I just thought, but hang on, like, so rather than me thinking, well, actually, do I want that stuff? I was just like, but you know, that's not an option to me, and I don't know what that's going to look like, which is just such a negative, awful generator of emotion, because you're only, like, when you're stuck in that rut, you're only looking at what you don't have. And part of me was like, hang on, I've got like immense amounts of freedom, like flexibility, like I could literally do whatever the hell I want with my life, which is kind of what I did. I kind of quit my job and went traveling, and I was like, kind of maybe look at it from that point of view versus like what is not in your future. Like, you kind of get to pick what's in your future to a certain extent.
Yeah, I remember saying to a friend a few years ago, when I kind of rebelled against all the people saying, you should get a boyfriend, you should, your window for having children is closing. And I remember saying, everyone is projecting a black hole on my life.
Yeah.
Everyone is saying there's something missing.
Yeah.
But I've never felt more complete. I'm like making my own money. I live in a place that I really like. And yet I'm everywhere I go, I'm being told that something's not quite 100%. And then I just was, you know, don't speak to those people anymore. And it, to be just a little note, in your circumstances as well, I now have become close to people who are living the life that I aspire to, and that makes such a big difference.
Yeah, it does. Well, also because you kind of reach a point where you gravitate towards those people, because they also just seem like super grounded. And you know, I mean, I love my parent friends and they are great, and we catch up when we catch up and so on. But also, they're like frazzled as shit. And I'm just like, and I kind of need a lie down afterwards. Like, I need a lie down. So I'm like, I don't know how they're dealing with it. But it's like, on the one hand, I'm very glad that we've caught up. But on the other hand, I find that I absolutely need that kind of counterpart of, usually it's actually, it tends to be older women. And when I say older, I mean like kind of, like late 50s, 60s, where we can just kind of have a chat about stuff. And I look at, like, there's this whole vibe that they give off, you know, where literally like nothing could knock them from where they're standing. And that just radiates out. And I just look at them and I'm like, in this creepy way, I really want to be you. I want to wear your skin and learn your
secrets.
That is
creepy. That is creepy.
But it's like,
just as an FYI.
Yeah, obviously I don't tell them that.
Just write it in your diary.
But like, I want to be them. And I think that it's very easy to forget, like, as your life goes through different changes and the older that you get, that you still really need people that you kind of aspire to be.
Yeah.
You know, who aren't people in the media or like who are celebrities, that are like actually just genuine, genuinely decent, normal people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. And I definitely find that as soon as I became, and it sounds like you did the same thing, as soon as I decided what I wanted, like, what will make me happy? What do I want my future to look like? Once I was honest with myself about that, it was amazing the things and people that left and the things that people that arrived.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't change it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, it's, I don't, I mean, people always go, are you happy? And I'm like, I don't know what that means. Like, I mean, yesterday I had a bag of McCoy's crisps and I was happy for about like 5 minutes. Like,
what flavour?
Obviously salt and vinegar.
I mean, God, the greatest crisps known to man.
They really are. But I'm like, shouldn't you be asking yourself, like, what gives your life meaning? Like, what is currently in your life? Like, and what did you choose out of that? And are they the things that you want to have in it. I mean, I know if you have kids, you can't exactly go, yeah, change my mind.
Yeah, there is that.
Like, reverse that process. but that kind of search for meaning, and I know that that will change from year to year, but I just feel that, like, regularly asking myself that question is really important.
I'm not a big fan of the expression, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
But I thought you might have a similar reaction. But, and I wouldn't say it with the big things. I think something that you've been through is massive. But one of the questions that I ask myself when something's happening and I'm like, I'm having thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, they're percolating in the back of my brain and I'm like, something's coming.
Yeah.
And I think, right, what am I supposed to learn from this?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a really useful question.
I completely agree. I mean, I know I kind of made a noise, but...
No, everything happens for a reason is...
Yeah. So the reason why I find that problematic, the other version of everything happens for a reason, is because it kind of... you obviously know this. It kind of like gives over to this idea that there's some like puppet master like pulling our strings of destiny or whatever. But I am a firm believer that in timing. So I think that there are right and wrong times for things. And so, for example, at various points in my life, when I have been pushing and pushing a door that should not be opened or it's just not the right time, the consequences can be disastrous if you just keep pushing for something which is just not what should be happening. And I've just noticed that when things are meant to be flowing in, or when I say meant to be flowing, is that you kind of know, but like these are all, it sounds intangible, but they're actually very definitive things. So it could be where you are at a certain point in your career, your skill set, you know, your financial circumstances, like the people who are in your network, like all of those things kind of coalesce to make something right for you at that point in time. And also your intuition around things, like your intuition around whether someone is a good person or a bad person to work with. So I do believe that there are kind of moments when, yes, something might, everything happens for a reason, but like that reason is not woo-woo. That reason is like quantifiable stuff.
I agree. I think, as you say, it gives over to the puppet master, or it's like, I'll take whatever life throws at me. And I don't know. I'm like you. I'm not a big fan of it.
No.
I think you make your own luck.
Yeah. And also, like, I don't know. Like, I kind of believed, this sounds really bleak, so I'm going to try it, but it's not actually bleak. But it's like, I genuinely believed before all of this stuff that happened with Rob that, you know, everyone has like one huge love story in them. And then once you kind of got that love story, everything else was going to work out. Like, this is kind of how, you know, innocent I was around things. And life just doesn't work that way. Like, you can have your love story and it can be amazing, but it's also going to kind of be quite challenging. And so, I don't know, like, I don't know that life, like, fully prepares you for that, but...
It's Hollywood again. Pulled up on movies where the end of the movie is where you fall in love and you both say it at the same time. But then what?
It's like, then it's like stuff like who needs to empty the dishwasher and...
It's also, and Sam and I on the last episode talked about this, where we talked about happiness isn't a destination.
No.
It's a continuing journey that you have to work at and navigate.
Yeah, I was about to say pit stop, but that's not very poetical. but like also no emotion is, like, happiness is an emotion. Like, you know, I mean, whether you're like angry or sad or whatever, like that's also like a huge thing that I had to remember and still actually have to tell myself when I'm feeling unbelievably sad about stuff. But it's like, you'll probably feel a bit differently tomorrow. And that's kind of how it works.
Yeah.
Because it's not like I've been perpetually sad for like, you know, 1,000 days or however long it's been. Like, there has been lots and lots of different feelings and experiences and emotions during that time.
And that's, for somebody, i.e. me, I don't know if you're the same, sensory overload, emotional sensory overload. For me, sometimes that's when I go to sleep. If I'm feeling lots of things, I just medicate by going to bed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky that I can do. Actually, Emma, you're pretty much the only other person that like can do that, apart from possibly me and my dad. Whenever I say that, people just like their eyes start twitching because I think like the majority of people find it difficult to sleep. Mm. But I'm like, no, I sleep like a ninja. Like, or rather, sleep is like the thing that I always retreat to because I kind of view it as like my body just being a champion and just going, you know what? Here's my act of kindness for you today. Yeah.
So I get insomnia, but if in the day it all gets too much, because I a couple of years ago was at the point where if I got an email from somebody and I wasn't sure of the tone, I'd spiral. Oh, okay. I could just go to bed.
Yeah.
And I would, my body would be like, okay, fine, you can be unconscious for a bit. Literally. And it would just put, it would pause those feelings, but that was the only way I could do it.
Yeah. But I think that that's your... that's your other Emma, like just kind of, you know, just stroking your hair a little bit, just going there.
Go to sleep.
Yes.
And then wake up and watch Real Housewives.
Yeah.
But then do some work at some point, please. Now, tell me about these workshops and talks that you've got in the pipeline.
Okay, so I am going to start launching or doing my own workshops and talks. Woo,
I'm excited.
Thanks. It kind of came out of a need of... as you know, I write a lot across mental well-being or like experiences that like people might be going through, maybe feeling quite isolated and alone and what they're going through. And also just other things like, you know, working on a passion project while you have a full-time job or like...
Ah, the side hustle.
Yes. I kind of feel like that's not quite the word that I am going to use, but I like side hustle.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I'm with you.
Yeah.
It's a means to an end.
Yes. But also like side hustle, I think is great in that, but to me it's too entrepreneurial for my taste. So like for me, I'm coming at it from a creativity point of view and how that kind of can also like productively feed into your day job. But like a huge part of it is also just genuinely like that kind of checking in with yourself and then recalibrating like what you want and what you need from your life and like what can be put in the bin and what are kind of some of the tiny changes that you can make. And I found that I was being asked to speak, which I'm very grateful for, like, you know, being able to contribute to that conversation, like panels and so on. Or people will contact me like through email. And I was just like, actually, I would really like to put something together, which means that either I can run these workshops, which I'm going to open out some of them to the general public. Some of them will be like workplace related. So like mental well-being, for example, in the workplace is something I feel hugely passionate about. But also I'm kind of like the third part of it is like a pro bono for young journalists. So like they're like it's going to be like a quarterly like free event for like young journalists who are like, I don't really know what to do. And also I'd like some advice on how to apply for jobs and what my boundaries should be around what I should say yes and no to.
And how much I should be charging. And I get that a lot. Yeah.
So I get like, I think that also came out from being emailed a lot about things. And I was like, I would love to meet everyone for coffee, but I just don't have time. And also I can kind of like construct it in a way that's actually going to be helpful for you and you can hear from your peers. But yeah, so I think a huge part of this for me is like, emotional intelligence, but also, I don't know, like I'm a very, very strong advocate for just kind of course correcting your life as it's going on versus like my biggest fear was like just, you know, being on my deathbed, like old and decrepit and like looking around my life and just being like, whose life is this? Like, I didn't really choose it. It kind of just like rolled me along with its speed. And so that is something that kind of that idea of autopilot is something that I feel really strongly about, kind of just jolting yourself out of it.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's brilliant. When will they, do you know when they'll be starting?
Yeah.
Because obviously we'll put the links to this in the show notes.
So the name of the workshop, which it doesn't quite have the same impact when you say it out loud versus reading it.
Okay.
But it's FML: Fix My Life.
Great.
And they're launching in September.
Listeners, you might be hearing we're under the flight path, but that seems like it was one of the mega jumbos.
Oh my god. Or do you think it was one of Donald Trump's planes?
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So
possibly.
So yeah, sorry. Yeah, we are kind
Please
of
don't
under
apologize,
the flight
but it's just
a little bit.
There have been a few, but that one did seem like
yeah.
It's carrying 800 people.
Yeah.
So they're going to be coming. Sorry. What time are they? What time?
They will be launching in September.
September.
And all of the stuff that I'm kind of pushing out on it is going to be, I'll be putting a website, but it's all on my Instagram anyway. Okay. So yeah.
And your Instagram is at?
Porna Bell. And fabulous. That's Porna with two O's.
Like I will poo. Be putting, I will be putting all the links to your website, your social media.
Thank you.
Everything that we've discussed. I'll be putting the link to the book. I met Porna and within an hour bought it on Kindle, bought her book on Kindle. So I will. And I highly recommend everyone read it because it is a beautiful, beautifully written book. It covers the topics that we've discussed today. It's hard going, but there's joy in there and there's...
Totally, yeah.
It's a brilliant book to read. And I hope everyone else experiences it because it's great. We've come to the end of our time together. But it's good to know that I can just come and stalk you at your workshops, if that's okay.
Why can't we just hang out normally? Like, why does it have to be at the workshops?
No, you're absolutely right. We'll put a dinner in the diary.
I promise I won't say that I'll wear your skin as a coat.
Although until you say it, I'll feel like we haven't got the mutual respect that we need. Right. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and this topic. I'm sure listeners may have lots of questions, so I invite you to email the show at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com or slide into my DMs on social, where I'm at Emma Guns. And obviously if you want to speak to Porna direct, fine. I will put all the links to her in the show notes. Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in. Listen, before you go, if you've enjoyed this episode and you want to get in touch with the show, simply email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com or why not slide into my DMs on Instagram and Twitter, where I'm at Emma Guns. It's one of my favourite things to hear from you. If you've enjoyed this episode and you feel like subscribing, then wherever it is that you stream this particular podcast, please do hit that subscribe button. And if it gives you the option to review, I'd be so grateful if you could leave it 5 stars and maybe even a sentence or two about what you enjoyed. Thank you so, so much for listening. My favourite part of the week is when I go through all of your emails and speak to you in the Facebook group, the link to which will be in the show notes. So I can't wait to have you back here again, same time next week for another episode of the show.